Hi, I'm the Enigma, and you're listening to the X-Cast.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the X-Cast, the truth is in here. I'm Carl Sweeney, sitting in for Tony Black once again, and I'm delighted today to be talking about the highly distinctive Season 2 X-Files episode, Humbug. And I'm delighted to be joined by none other than Tanya Hernandez. Hello, Tanya.
Hello and welcome. Thank you again for having me on. I was looking forward to it.
Yes, my pleasure. Now, longer-term listeners of the X-Cast will remember Tanya from the sort of earliest days of the podcast. You were on the very first full-length episode, I believe.
Yes, talking about I attended the here in New York City, the New York Comic Con, where they premiered the first episode of the mini-season. I got to attend that, so I got to talk to Tony about my experience with it and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then you were on quite a bit of the sort of Season 10 episodes,
yes.
Weren't you?
Yeah. Yes, I did that, and I might have... I'm not sure if I did a Season 1 episode or two here and there, but yeah, I did a couple of the early talks about the new season and stuff like that, so it was a lot of fun. It was just great to just talk about X-Files again, and I was thrilled to work with Tony on that. It just brought me back to the heyday when X-Files was on and everybody was on the internet, on message boards and stuff like that. It just reminded me of all that excitement the fans had for the show. So I was glad to be a part of that.
Yeah, it brings back so many memories, doesn't it, from the sort of heyday, the 1990s. Well, you're back for an interesting episode. But before we get on to Humbug, let me just give the listeners a few links. So this is about how you can get in touch with us in other ways rather than just listening to the podcast. So we're on Twitter. If you want to find us on Twitter, you can go to @thex_cast. We've also got a Facebook group. If you search for XCast, you'll be able to find us, and the full name is the XCast Podcast and X-Files Fan Group. Our blog has recently moved again, so the current address is thex-cast.blogspot.co.uk, and all our articles and reviews and so on are on there. And we've got an email address finally, so it's thexfcast@gmail.com. And we've just got one other favour to ask, really, which is that it would really help us if you just went to iTunes, found us on there, and rated and reviewed the podcast, preferably with a decent rating. That helps us reach more listeners, basically. So that, once again, just go to iTunes, find us on there, and it'd really help us if you can leave us a nice review. So, Tanya, if you're ready, we'll get on to talking about Humbug. Right, so Humbug is the 20th episode of Season 2 of The X-Files. It originally aired for the first time on March the 31st, 1995. It was written by Darren Morgan and directed by Kim Manners. And the plot sees Mulder and Scully travel to a small town in Florida, inhabited by sideshow performers, to search for a killer.
What happened to him?
Nothing you can ascertain from that photograph. The victim suffered from ichthyosis, a congenital skin disease characterized by the shedding of the epidermis in the form of scales. This shows the entry wound of the undetermined weapon. There were no other injuries inflicted upon the body. No internal organs removed and or cannibalized, and there's no signs of any sexual molestation either. It's 48 attacks over the last 28 years, occurring in every state in the continental U.S. almost, the first in Oregon, the last five in Florida. The victims range from all different age groups, races, both male and female. The mutilations appear so motiveless that one would suspect some form of ritual. Yet they adhere to no known cult. And a lone serial killer would have been expected to escalate the level of violence of his attacks over such an extended period of time. So what do you think, Scully? What are your initial thoughts?
Imagine going through your whole life looking like this.
Okay, Tanya, so Humbug, marks out of 10. How good an episode of The X-Files is this?
Out of 10... So it's definitely one of my favorites, and it's, I mean, I think for any X-Filer, it's a must-watch episode. This is, I guess, what you would consider the first comedic, you know, comedy-focused episode. Out of 10, oh, man, 8.59?
8.59.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think I would rate it that pretty high. I mean, I could watch it over and over again and still, like, laugh out, you know, LOL in real life. You know what I mean? I mean, I was watching it as I was watching it again to refresh myself. It's just so great to just see, like, the humor. Like, the subtle, dry humor and some of the, like, the visual cues in it. They're just so, so funny. Like, it's such a great, well-put-together episode. I can't gush enough about it.
Yeah, I'd agree with pretty much all of what you said there. I'd give it an 8 out of 10. That's my rating. And maybe in a minute we'll come on to talk about how this sort of ranks in the Darren Morgan canon. I mean, he was only responsible for a few episodes. And I'll be interested to hear where you think this rates among those. Yeah, I agree with what you say. Very funny. Lots of great moments. And hopefully we'll talk about them all during the course of this podcast. The only slight thing I would say about it, not really a criticism, but I don't really find the murder storyline that interesting in and of itself. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think the great stuff is the humour, all the sorts of the characters we meet. But if I compare it to some of his other episodes, the murder itself doesn't grab me that much. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't see why the FBI would, even in an X-Files capacity, want to waste his resources on a case like this. You know, yeah. Like I said, even for an X-File.
Yeah.
But I guess because Mulder is Mulder and he just has to be the weirdo of the two, he you know, it's like, let's just annoy Scully some more and drag her off. So this, you know, it's not an extraordinary, like, type of murder like they've investigated in other episodes, but yeah, I could see why that doesn't make it a, you know, definitely a 10. I could see why it's an 8. I could see why you would say that.
Well, I think it might be a good time to, before we get into it in detail, let's just bring up the subject of Darren Morgan, because a lot of people listening will be familiar with him, but maybe not everybody will. So let's just give a bit of background about him. He's obviously the brother of Glenn Morgan, another writer on The X-Files. So far in The X-Cast, we've looked at a couple of episodes that Darren Morgan has had a bit of a part in. The first one was The Host, and he, of course, played the Fluke Man.
Played the Fluke Man, yep, that's right.
And then the very next episode, he has a credit on Blood. It says Story by Darren Morgan, I think.
Okay.
Whether or not he had much to do with it is a bit of a matter for debate, I believe.
The vampire one?
No, it's the one with like the electronic devices that have...
Oh, right, that make you triggered and start killing people. Right.
Yeah, I don't believe he wrote it, but he had... either he came up with the idea or he did something that justified getting a credit on it. Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then this is the first one he writes, and we're going to talk about that, obviously, in depth. And then after this one, he goes on to write Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose.
Oh, which is another classic.
Yeah, that is a great episode, I believe, yeah. He writes War of the Coprophages.
Okay,
another one. AKA the Cockroach episode.
Cockroach episode, yeah. Yeah. Bambi. Her name is Bambi?
Her name is Bambi, yeah, that's right. His final season 3 episode was Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
When it comes to the significant humorous episodes, like, he just knocks it out of, like, those are just like home run after home run after home run when it comes to, like, X-Files top episodes that you always want to watch, you know.
Yeah.
he just hits those out the park when it comes to those episodes, man.
He really does. But sadly, then he left the series. He didn't write any more until the revival, at least. I believe I heard a story that he was going to write a season 4 episode, but for one reason or another, it fell through, and that meant that Carter and co. had to come up with Memento Mori quite quickly.
Oh.
And supposedly it means they accelerated the Scully cancer storyline, because they had to get the script ready in a bit of a hurry, I believe. But then he does return in an acting capacity in Small Potatoes in the role of Eddie Van Blunt, but he didn't write that one. Vince Gilligan wrote it. And then we had to wait all the way until the new miniseries, and he wrote and directed Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster.
Weremonster, which, again, is probably the best episode in the miniseries.
Yeah, I think most people seem to think that was the best episode of the new bunch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
All right. So that's who Darren Morgan is. So where does Humbug fit in with those other episodes that we talked about that he wrote for you, Tanya? Is it as good as Clyde Bruckman and Jose Chung?
I think Clyde Bruckman is the best one out of those, because it while humorous, it fit better in scope to, similar to what you were saying, like, you know, the murder fit better in terms of, like, what the FBI would allow for an investigation to be.
Yeah.
So it fit better, and it had... It really had a lot of different layers to it. Like, it was humorous, but, you know, you felt for this man. And even though he was kind of like, you know, screw everybody, like, he still felt like he had to do something, even though he was reluctant to do it. And then, you know, at the ending, you know, with Scully, and it just, it touched your heart, you know, you had the feels. It just had so many different layers to it, for it being one of the quote-unquote comedic episodes.
Yeah.
I think that was the best one out of the ones that he's done. I would say maybe Humbug would be maybe second or third after that, you know, in terms of comparing it to, like, Jose Chung, which I love Jose Chung, but that's just, like, a quirky, wacky episode. And then, of course, the Were-Monster, I think, is on level with Jose Chung. It's about just as crazy. And just, like, completely whacked out, but so much fun. Like, those two episodes are, like, more fun than anything. And even the characters have fun in those episodes, you know what I mean?
Yes, I do,
But, yeah, I would say after Clyde Bruckman, I would put Humbug either after or third.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think Clyde Bruckman is the best one as well. I think that's more or less perfect, really, from start to finish. I think I'd probably put Jose Chung second. I'm still thinking about the Were-Monster. I know it's been a year now, but I'm still sort of working out where it fits in. I think I might put Mulder and Scully Meet the Were-Monster third, then Humbug, I think.
Okay.
And I think Humbug and War of the Coprophages are similar-ish in quality, but I'd probably just put Humbug ahead. But it's not a criticism, because I think all five of them are, you know, are fine episodes.
It's just one little things here and there, just put it, you know, put one episode above the other, but by minute, you know, standards, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think because he's responsible for only a small number, I always feel the temptation to sort of to rank them, whereas with, you know, Chris Carter wrote 70 or something, I don't spend much time thinking about my top 10 Chris Carter episodes in the same way. Tony thinks Humbug is his fourth favourite Darren Morgan episode, he mentioned to me. But okay. I don't know what the order is for Tony.
Okay. But, we'll have to get the torture devices on him and get that.
Yeah. hopefully he'll reveal everything when he records Clyde Bruckman in the future.
Nice, nice.
Anyway, as you mentioned, Tanya, so this is going back to Humbug now. It's the... commonly regarded as the first comedy episode of the series. And I found an interesting quote about the sort of inspiration for it. And apparently it was Morgan's brother Glenn originally came up with the idea. So I've got a quote from Darren Morgan. He says, the word came down from Glenn, do an episode about circus freaks. And then so Darren Morgan immediately sat down to watch some videotapes to get some ideas. Morgan did a ton of research on the history of sideshows and circus performers, apparently. And once he started to write it, he found he couldn't help but write it with a humorous slant. So he said he wasn't trying to be goofy. He wasn't told to do a funny X-File. He just wrote an episode that would have enough scares and be strange enough to be an X-File, and where the comedy would be good enough that they would let it slide. And that's what they did. They said, okay, we're going to go with it. So it's interesting that it may not necessarily have been intended exactly how it transpired. And I've got some quotes from Chris Carter talking about the thinking behind that, and Carter said that the studio was nervous about Humbug, but probably the most nervous person was director Kin Manners, who confessed to having a panic attack. He realised he was responsible for filming the first comedy X-Files.
Oh, wow.
And apparently all the way through shooting it, Manners had no idea whether it was going to work or not. And here's what he said. He said, this is only the second episode I directed, and Chris Carter wants to explore new ground. And I'm the guy that's going to take the patient into the operating room and do an entirely unproved operation and see if it's still going to have a heartbeat when it leaves surgery. And it did. but I was really scared to death. And then he says, I've been directing in television for 16 years, and it was the first time since the first episode of television I ever did that I've literally been frightened. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that we don't necessarily give it much of a second thought now, do we? But all the great comedy episodes that followed, this was a big thing.
Yeah, that's amazing that that when you put it in that way, he definitely put a lot of pressure on himself. But I mean, you know, I guess some people work well under pressure, so it worked out really well.
It did. In hindsight, it worked out very well, like we say. Yeah. So I just had. I don't know if you're a baseball fan at all, Tanya.
I live in the Bronx, New York, so yeah, I'm a Yankees fan.
Okay.
Definitely.
The reason I ask is I've got a Chris Carter quote which involves a baseball analogy about humbug.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. So you might have to explain this one to me.
Okay.
Carter said that he thought this was a pretty big departure from what they'd done before, and I guess we can see what he means there. But he thought that this was about the 45th episode, almost, and that they'd earned the right to stretch a little. So what he said was, we'd been throwing fastballs and curveballs, and this was a knuckleball, something new to our repertoire.
That's a good description.
Yeah, what's a knuckleball, exactly?
So there's different pitches that the pitcher throws based on how they hold the actual baseball. So a knuckleballer, usually what they do is they like dig their index and middle finger into the top of the baseball and then like kind of grip it on the top, like where your nail is, and it ends up like when they throw it, like the throw is like completely crazy, like it throws batters off all the time. So I could see that's a good analogy, that, you know, you've been throwing your usual stuff, you know, things that you expect, and then when a knuckleballer comes into a game and they start throwing, like, it just throws everybody off, and you don't expect it, basically. So it's a pretty cool analogy. That's a pretty good analogy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty appropriate, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So we heard a bit from Kim Manners and Chris Carter, but I've got a quote about Morgan's reaction on seeing the final episode when it was finished, and he said, I was so depressed after Humbug that I felt suicidal. I think he's very, what's the word? Very sort of self-critical of his episodes. From what I've heard, he's quite happy with how Clyde Bruckman and Jose Chung turned out. He's less happy with Humbug and War of the Coprophages, is what I understand.
That's a shame, because it's such a good episode. Like, you know, especially the scene at the end where Dr. Blockhead is explaining, like, how the world is changing. And the scene where he's like, you know, you'll be able to, you know, genetically pick what you want, and you end up looking like him. And then, like, when you see Mulder standing there with his arms to the side and his foot up, like, you know, like, looking like Superman, like, it's such a funny scene. And it's such a great line, like, oh, man, it's you know, I guess, you know, the artists sometimes could never fully appreciate their own work. You know, I know as an artist myself, like, sometimes you're like, oh, this is crap, you know, and people are like, no, it's not. It's really good. So I feel bad that he felt that way about this episode, because it's such a good episode.
I would hope that over the course of time he's, you know, become a bit fonder of it, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully he's listened to, like, us, the fans, telling him, no, it's really good, it's our favorite, trust us.
Well, as you mentioned, the fans, on IMDb, this has an average rating of 8.8 out of 10.
Okay.
And that's been rated by 2,936 people. Yeah, that's so good. The fans agree more with us than with Morgan himself.
And with Darren, poor guy.
I mean, IMDb does tend to be a bit high, but of the season 2 episodes, only Colony, Endgame, and Anasazi have got a higher rating than this one, and Dwayne Barry and Ascension have the same rating, 8.8 out of 10. So the fans basically think it's up there with the best from this second season.
It's the truth. It's not even just, you know, blowing smoke. Like, it's really one of the episodes you think of when you think of, like, your favorite episodes, or like when you're on flipping through channels on TV and you see it on, you're like, oh, I gotta stop and watch this episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, Tanya, you mentioned you had a bit of a story related to this episode.
I do.
Do you want to tell us?
Yes. So when Tony messaged me and asked me would I be interested in, you know, doing another episode and doing Humbug, I was like, oh yeah, absolutely. So this past Monday in preparation, I was like, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch Humbug. So I put on my PlayStation, I turn on Netflix, and to my horror, Netflix removed X-Files from the service. And I didn't know this. And I'm like, what the hell? So I'm like scrambling. I'm like, damn it. You know, I know it was on Hulu, but I'm not signing up for Hulu to watch it. So I was like, all right, let me just break out the DVDs. You know, I have the original DVD sets. So I pull out my DVD and I put it into my system and I'm watching it, and it was nostalgic to see it in 4:3 again.
Yep.
But I was like, I've been spoiled by the HD.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, this can't happen again. So after I watched the episode, I went on to Amazon and I purchased the Blu-ray set.
Yeah.
I purchased the entire Blu-ray box set because I had hesitated buying it since I had the DVDs, but I was like, oh no, I can't watch another episode in 4:3 again. I need my HD. So, and today I actually just received it about like 2 hours ago, and I actually recorded an unboxing that I have to edit and put on YouTube.
Yeah.
So thank you, Tony, and thank you, Humbug, for pushing me to buy the box set, as any crazy X-Files fan would do.
Yeah, you're in for a treat there, because the Blu-rays look excellent, I think. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I saw them on Netflix, the HD transfers were incredible. I was like, wow. So, you know, it was like, all right, I will buy the Blu-rays eventually, just not now, but... Thanks to this episode, it pushed me to go get them.
Yeah,
to go get them. But they were cheaper than they were at release, so yes. I didn't mind it. It turned out really well.
Oh, yeah. So does your set have the new episodes in as well?
I already had purchased the new episodes separate when it released.
Oh, okay.
So when I ordered the box set, I ordered it without the episodes because it was cheaper, too.
Yeah.
But if anybody watches my unboxing, you'll see that my box set came with it.
Oh.
So I got it for free without paying extra for it. So now I have two copies of the new season on Blu-ray.
Wow.
Yeah,
maybe you can give it away as a gift or something.
I know. I was thinking about that. I was like, maybe I'll send it to one of my friends who's an X-Files fan, one of my good friends.
Okay, thank you, Tanya. Now it's time to take an in-depth look at Humbug. Okay, so it starts off quite effectively, I think, because the opening sequence sort of straight away it sort of misdirects you, doesn't it? Because as a viewer watching it for the first time, you very quickly assume that the guy is going to attack the kids in the pool, don't you?
Yeah, when I was watching it, I was like, oh man, this starts off just like a typical X-Files episode. There's a guy creeping in the shadows, breathing hard.
Yeah.
His skin is all funky looking. You're like, oh man, these kids are going to get it. And then, Dad!
So it's highly appropriate because a lot of the rest of the episode is about the assumptions we make, isn't it?
Right.
So it's quite
a misdirection.
Yeah, it's quite a nice way of doing that. So the sort of second part to it is that there is an attacker, and it's the dad who gets it. It's a good start to the episode, I think.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was a nice again. There goes the knuckleballer reference to, you know, you're expecting one thing and then something completely different happens. So it was a nice way to open up the episode and set up how the rest of the episode was going to work, because you see that constantly throughout the episode in different interactions, you know, between characters and in events. It's you expect this to happen and then something else comes in and it does something completely different, which was really nice. I like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit like what he does in Jose Chung as well, where you get like a standard alien abduction, and then you get the second set of Lord Kimbo turns up to abduct the aliens.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an early version of that, in a way. The guy who died is Gerald Glazebrook, the Alligator Man. And then after the credits, we get a nice little scene in the X-Files office. And I think it's a very well-played scene, actually. So Mulder goes on his kind of spiel about the background to the case and everything, and how many people have gone missing. And Scully's kind of distracted, isn't she? Because she's kind of she's more focused in
his appearance and what, you know, his physical appearance.
Yeah, and she says, imagine going through your whole life looking like this. Both of them play it very well, I think. It's one of the relevant quotes about the episode, isn't it? Because it introduces these characters, and it's Mulder and Scully who are more concerned, really, with the way they look than the people themselves in a lot of ways. It's quite a brief scene, though, because it leads to the funeral of Gerald Glazebrook, and it's quite a distinctive, unique funeral. It introduces... We see quite a few of the characters we're going to meet through the rest of the episode. So we see the sheriff, we see Lanny, and I think it's established that he drinks during the funeral.
Right.
And Dr. Blockhead appears from under the ground to sort of gatecrash the funeral.
Right.
And Mulder and Scully are really just bystanders, or not bystanders, but they're onlookers. I can't remember if they say, I don't think they say in the office that it's kind of a sideshow community, but it very quickly establishes that it is in this scene.
Yeah. You know, I just like when everybody dispersed, they're just sitting there like, okay, well, that just happened.
Yeah. He said, you know? What does he say? I can't wait for the wake.
I can't wait for the wake. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, apparently, Gibsonton is a real sideshow community, but in the years since Humbug aired, you know, the community has continued to decline, which is kind of sad, I think.
Was this supposed to be in Florida? Is that correct?
In Florida. Okay. Yeah, Gibsonton in Florida. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They had a bit of trouble filming this funeral scene, apparently. So Kim Manners said it was a Monday morning, and it had snowed over the weekend before. So they arrived, and the ground was thick with snow.
Oh, my God.
And they had guys with, you know, blowtorches going around melting all the snow, and they brought in a truck, like a water truck, to wash everything away, and then a steam truck to finish preparing. So they had a bit of a rough start to the week, it sounds like.
That's hilarious that they had to create... Florida. Well, they didn't put palm trees or anything, but they had to create some place not frozen south where it's warm in like a day or so. Oh, that's crazy. I can't believe, like, just a side note, like how long the show lasted in Vancouver for so long, considering like some of these like weather problems that would create issues with the script if it took place anywhere not cold, you know what I mean? Or not indoors.
Yeah, well, you definitely see when they get to LA in season 6, they immediately start doing episodes in deserts and
right,
you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Like, finally.
Yeah. And, you know, stuff like the Rain King.
Or where you see the actual palm trees.
Yeah,
and
that's
you
right.
See the ocean, you know?
Yeah. I watched it on the Blu-ray as well, and I didn't see any sign of snow, so they did a pretty good job of, you know, getting rid of it all.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Then they head to the diner to have a chat with the sheriff, and this is where Mulder develops his theory that the Fiji Mermaid might be involved, because he sees it on the menu. And they later go to see the funhouse operator, Hepcat Helm, and he also leads Mulder on to think that the Fiji Mermaid might have some involvement with this.
Right. It's a house of terror.
Yes. A tabernacle of terror.
Tabernacle of terror, yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose you can see that the Fiji Mermaid is kind of in the realm of the stuff the X-Files usually does, but that sort of gets dropped fairly quickly.
Yeah, when, of course, Scully starts looking at the hard evidence.
At the hard evidence, yes. So then they check into, they check into the trailer court, and they meet Mr. Nutt, who's the manager of the trailer court. Now, I'm not sure if you're a Twin Peaks fan at all.
Yes,
Tanya.
Yes, they both worked in Twin Peaks, yes. I always tend to notice those little things like, oh, wait, they worked together in Twin Peaks. That's so cool.
Yeah.
This really nice association, and then the fact that, you know, it's coming out again on Showtime.
Yeah.
Side note, have you seen the picture of David in his character again, Denise?
I have seen the picture, yeah.
Oh, man, it's so good. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, so as we record this, Twin Peaks is, what, about 6 weeks away from returning?
Yeah, something like that, yep.
Yeah, by the time people hear this, it'll be even closer. And I can't wait to see what they come up with, basically. It could go brilliantly, or it could go
really bad.
Yeah, I don't know which way it's going to go. But if anyone has seen Twin Peaks, this guy, Mr. Nutt, is the character here. The actor is Michael J. Anderson, and he plays, I believe his character is called The Man from Another Place. right. in Twin Peaks, and it's very
talks backwards. And,
yeah, he's in some very memorable sequences in the Red Room in Twin Peaks. And they have a really funny discussion here about reducing people to stereotypes. Mr. Nutt is saying that Mulder has assumed that, or he asks him about...
Oh, that he was a carnival performer.
Yeah, have you done much circus work in your life?
Right.
And he goes on a whole sort of diatribe about how basically Mulder's taken one look at him and reduced him to a stereotype. And he sort of profiles Mulder, doesn't he? And he talks about like his unimaginative necktie design and various things.
Right.
And he deduces that he's an FBI agent. And, I think this is one of the highlights of the episode, this scene.
Yeah. Such a great interaction. And he's like, but I am an FBI agent.
Yeah. Well.
So good.
Yeah, and he gets his badge out, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently, this scene was even longer originally, but they had to cut the end off, or they decided to cut the end off. So, Darren Morgan said that there was a gag David Duchovny came up with on the set. So the manager goes for his big long spiel about making judgments based on people's appearances. Mulder says he is an FBI agent and shows his badge. And then what should have happened is this. So the manager says, sign here, please. And you see a close-up of a hand ringing a bell. When they shot it, the manager turns to Scully and says, are you an FBI agent as well? Scully nods. And then Mr. Nutt says, but you're a woman. And then Gillian reacts as if to say, what? You know, I'm going to kill you.
Right.
But before she could speak, Mulder leans over and rings the bell. And that was how the scene would have ended.
Oh, okay.
They were concerned that it would have come across as trying to be too funny. And they made the decision to cut that bit out. But it's a shame.
I think it could have worked still.
Yeah, I don't think it's... There is a deleted scene on the DVD, but it's not this. Right.
It's not that one, yeah. No. It's another one in the restaurant, I think.
Yeah, with a waiter. Or waitress. And, it's a shame that we didn't get to see this bit. But, hey, apparently it exists. What's also funny is that the very next scene is Lanny is carrying their baggage to the room. And the first thing Mulder says is, have you done much circus work in your life? Despite the whole conversation before.
The whole thing before. That he had, He's still being an ass, basically.
Yeah, basically, yeah. The guy playing Lanny... the actor's name was Vincent Schiavelli. Yeah, I don't know if you recognize him from anything else.
Oh, he just has that look that he's been in tons of other things. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but you recognize that actor all the time.
Where I associate him from, apart from the X-Files, is he had quite a big role in the James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies as a kind of a hitman.
Okay.
And he also appeared in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
He was one of the patients in that. And yeah, if you have a look at his IMDb, he's got a long list of credits. He's always, an interesting actor. It's always nice when he pops up in stuff.
He's always a distinctive character.
Yeah.
He always plays that, it's like, okay, yeah, that's the role for you,
Yeah.
And he has such a distinctive look too,
He absolutely does, yeah. And he comes on to, as it turns out, he has a pivotal role in this episode. I think the next thing we see is the murder of Hepcat Helm, the funhouse operator. I don't have much to say about the murder, unless you do.
The only thing, when I was watching this again, I'm like, this little thing must be the fastest and strongest thing I have ever seen, because I don't know about you.
Yeah.
But if I see that little thing, crawling around at me, it's getting stomped. He is getting stomped, and I don't care how fast he's moving. He is getting stomped. So, either his look was so terrifying that they just froze people in place. But, like I said, I live in New York. I run across mice and rats running across. They're going to get stomped. So that guy, I don't know what happened to him. I wouldn't have gone down without a fight, let me tell you.
Yeah, I didn't think about it like that. Yeah,
that's the only, the one big caveat about the episode is, again, to go along with your point about, the murders and stuff not being that significant, that thing wasn't very big. And I don't understand how he's taken out. I can understand the one in the pool, okay?
Yeah.
But that scene, dude, you got knives and hammers and chisels in your workshop. You telling me you couldn't take one of those objects and throw it at this thing and smack him really good as he's leaping at you like a flying squirrel or something? Like, yeah. that was the one thing I will say, like, was a bit, like, beyond
stretching belief. Disbelief.
Yeah. It's like, that little thing was way too small to be taking out these big grown people, you know? Especially, like,
definitely.
Fully in, like, he wasn't drunk and he wasn't asleep.
No,
he was
that's
fully
right,
awake,
yeah.
You know, like, I can understand if you're taken, you know, while you're asleep or drunk or high or something like that, but he was fully awake and cognizant of his surroundings. So, yeah, that was the one thing I, when I was watching that again, I was like, how the hell did he take this guy out?
Yeah, well, I suppose it was similar to what I was saying at the beginning, really, that, I think the murders here sort of they do the job of moving the plot along well enough. But if I compare it to like Clyde Bruckman, you know, where I don't think there's really a wasted moment in that episode.
No, and you know, it made sense. Like I said, like this thing wasn't even leaping from the top rafters. He came from a window on the floor.
Yeah,
and yeah. Leaped up somehow. Like, you know, whatever. I mean, it's X-Files.
It's X-Files. We'll
it's X-Files.
Yeah. Yeah, so the next morning, Mulder's out for a run, and he sees the conundrum. And this guy was credited as the Enigma in real life.
Yeah.
I don't know what his birth name was. There's quite a funny story on the Blu-ray set, actually. I assume it's on the DVD as well. It's where Chris Carter says they got this guy coming into the office, and they were all a bit unsure about, you know, how the meeting was going to go. And they asked him if he'd like anything to eat, and they were surprised when he said, yeah, I'd like a cookie, please.
Again,
yeah.
Playing off of assumptions.
Oh, yes, that's a good point, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so just as a reminder, this is the guy who's got a jigsaw puzzle tattooed across his body.
Oh, his body,
and,
yes.
And when Mulder sees him, he's eating a big fish, isn't he, from the,
yes,
from the water.
I'm sure he was actually eating a fish.
Yeah.
Because that did not look fake.
No, he didn't. No, that's right. And what's funny is that the conundrum takes one look at Mulder and runs away.
Like, whoa, that guy, he's too much for me. I'm scared of him. Meanwhile, I'm eating a fish raw on the side of the water.
Absolutely. Yeah. Meanwhile, back in the trailer, Scully awakes and she sees a trampoline. You know, she doesn't know what's happening. She wakes up and somebody's jumping up and down outside a window. And then she receives a knock on the door and it's Lanny. And there's a nice little moment where Scully's dressing gown is slightly, you know, revealing too much, slightly open, yeah. And so is Lanny's, revealing his some of his conjoined twin. And they both sort of eye each other up in quite an amusing way.
Yeah, and both cover up at the same time.
Yeah.
I just love that dichotomy that just happens in a bunch of the scenes. I guess it plays off of, again, you know, assumptions and, you know, things like that. And the whole, I guess, the idea of twins was really big in the episode too, so you always see like these scenes that pair together.
Yeah. Yes.
A lot. So that keeps going, like that's a theme you see a lot in the episode, which is fitting towards the end when you get to the resolution. So that was like a really great scene, you know, to display that. The both of them covering up at the same time.
Yeah. I think you're definitely right there. And Baron Morgan said that this is how he explained what he was trying to do there, basically. So he said that people look at other people's body parts without trying to look like they're looking.
Right.
If any man were to see Scully in a bathrobe and it was slightly ajar, he would glance, but trying to look like he was not glancing. And I believe it's the same way with people's deformities. You don't want to stare, and yet you're attracted. And so I was playing off those inclinations. Yeah, which fits in quite nice, you know, ties in quite well with what you said, I think. So there's a bit of a scene where they investigate the crime scene. And I think the significance of it is they start to develop a theory that there's some kind of contortionist might have been able to get through the window.
Which is funny, considering they definitely have experience with that.
Yeah.
With Mr. Toombs.
Yeah.
So, but... And you see Scully doesn't even flinch on that one. She's like, well, you know, maybe...
Yeah, remember that time? They don't bring up past cases as much as they should do. Definitely,
but you see, like she doesn't have a reaction to the thought completely. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. Interestingly, I think in the episode Soft Light, there's some kind of aspect of that crime scene that reminds them of Toombs, and they refer back to it there. But
here
they don't. But they come across Dr. Blockhead. He's the kind of escape artist, I believe. And this actor's name is Jim Rose, and he was the founder of something called the Jim Rose Circus.
Yes.
Which I believe is still active.
I think so.
Yeah.
I know, and I've heard it for years, yeah.
And it also featured in an episode of The Simpsons called Homerpalooza. I don't know if you watch The Simpsons, Fanny.
Not anymore, but I used to.
Yeah, this was back in the day. It was an episode where Homer became a human cannonball.
Oh, yes, 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 okay.
The Jim Rose Circus had some kind of role in that episode as well. And so he's there, the conundrum's there, and there's an aspect of this scene we have to mention, which is where Scully is offered and puts in her mouth a live cricket.
Yes.
And on the Blu-ray, there's a behind-the-scenes clip of them filming this.
Yes. Yeah, it's on the DVD set, too.
Yeah, and the crew gives her a big round of applause when she finishes the scene. I think the first time I saw this, it does surprise me that Scully sort of rises to the challenge, you know?
Right. I mean, when you think about the character and how, you know, when she talks about how she had to be one of the boys and show, you know, that she could hang with her brothers and stuff, it makes sense. That you could see a young Scully being dared to eat like a worm or something like that. And
yeah.
So I'm not surprised that she did it. And it's a really cool scene. And I just love the dichotomy of the scene. You see how casually she just eats the cricket.
Yeah.
And Mulder's face.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Priceless. Priceless. And then when they walk away, he's like looking at her like, did you really just do that? It's so good. It's so good. And I remember years ago when the X-Files, in its heyday, when they did the X-Files Expo that were doing conventions. And so I went to the one here in New York City, and I remember Jillian was there, and she was asked, like, you know, she took some questions, and someone asked her, like, did you really eat that cricket? And she said, on stage, she goes, yes, I put that thing in my mouth. And people are like, oh, God! You know? So I have to give it to her for, like, she's, you know, being a trooper in that scene, because I'm sure she was like, oh, God. But it's nice to see, like, the character. It goes with the character, because you think, you know, Scully's the more sane of the two, but, you know, she's got to take a risk. She'll take a risk just to prove a point, you know what I mean? So it was a cool scene. It's a really, really great scene.
It is really cool, and it's this part of the episode is like 10 to 15 minutes where there's stuff like this, which don't necessarily move the plot forward that much, but it's just so much fun that you don't really mind, you know what I mean?
Again, I guess, you know, Chris and his infinite baseball analogy wisdom. Again, you don't expect that, but it happens, you know, and it's really cool. And then again, another misdirection where she's like, oh, you know, sleight of hand. I didn't really eat that, you know. It was really, really good scene. Really good scene.
Yeah, very memorable. And then they split up. Mulder's off investigating. I think he steals the nail, doesn't he, off Dr. Blockhead?
Yes.
Yeah,
to check the blood, yeah.
So he's off investigating. Scully wanders into the Museum of Curiosities, which is another memorable little sequence.
Which, you know, it's funny, now that you say it like that, how they switch roles, because usually Scully would be the one taking the blood to get the hard evidence, and Mulder would be the one investigating the mysterious lore. Or whatever. Yeah, meanwhile, in this scene, they completely flip-flop.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. She's the one that's going about, you know, learning Carney history and stuff like that, and seeing if she could get clues from somebody in some abstract way. And meanwhile, he's the one that went and took the blood and was like, I'm going to get this matched up.
Yeah.
You know? It's funny. Like, when you just put that in that way, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, they totally flip, like, roles.
Yeah, that's a good point, because when we get to the end, not to jump ahead, but they also flip roles a bit at the end of the episode, but we'll talk about that when we get there.
Right.
But in this museum sequence, so the actor's name here is Alex Deakin, and I believe Darren Morgan has put him in every other episode that he's written, so he's in all the X-Files episodes.
Is he the one that was in Clyde Bruckman that gives the accurate reading?
Yes, I believe so, and he dies in that, doesn't he?
Right, yeah, okay. Okay, see, I knew I recognized him. Every time I see the episode, I'm like, I know I recognize that guy. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. That's cool.
And then he's in War of the Coprophages. I believe he's one of the guys who lives in the building where one of the cockroach attacks happens.
Oh, okay.
And then in Jose Chung, he's the hypnotist who interviews the two, the guy and the girl who had been out on a date.
Oh, okay.
And then in the Weremonster episode, he's the motel manager.
Manager.
Like the Peeping
Tom.
Oh,
wow. I love when they reuse the actors like that. Yeah. You know, it's great. So
there's something about him that Darren Morgan really likes. I believe he's also in Morgan's two Millennium episodes as well, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we don't get a full look at him here. We always see him we see him reflected, don't we?
Yeah.
Which I like. I like the way they film that. Apparently part of it is that they were a bit unsure about how the makeup would look on camera. So they wanted to film it in a way that didn't necessarily showcase it in case the effect wasn't as they intended. But as it turned out, what we see looks really good, I think. And he tells them Scully asks him about the story of Chang and Eng, which are the conjoined twins. And relating to what you were saying, this sort of, it's a bit of foreshadowing of Lanny and Lenny later on.
Right.
Talks about their pain and their suffering.
Definitely. Which I guess that was the hint that he was trying to give.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess when you talk, you know, when you think about it, maybe that was the hint that he was actually trying to give, and not the one with the room, with the empty room. Or he took the $5 from her.
Yeah, he tricks Scully out of $5, but he does...
Yeah. Get her thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, he also gives them a bit of information about the sheriff, because he leads her on to believe that Jim the dog-faced boy is now the sheriff.
Right.
So then it's back to the trailer court, and Mulder disturbs Mr. Nutt, who's underneath Scully's trailer doing the plumbing.
Right.
And Mulder assumes that he's up to no good, basically, but it turns out that he is just doing the plumbing.
Yeah, because she comes out and she goes, oh, did he fix the plumbing? You're like... Damn.
Yeah.
Again. Foiled again by my assumptions.
And, again, it's funny, but it serves a wider purpose, which is great. It leads to another very funny scene, which is where they decide to investigate the sheriff. And before they see the sheriff digging something in the backyard, and they talk a bit about how they're discriminating. You know, just because he used to be a dog-faced boy and he's not anymore... They compare it to discriminating based on skin colour, I think.
Right,
then
yes.
The funny thing is that they pause and then they proceed anyway. And they exhume the potato. And the way David Duchovny says, we were exhuming your potato, every time it makes me laugh. It's a great... it's fantastic.
Yeah. I think... I don't know why I always... Again, I don't know why, but I always... think I remember he was burying bones like a dog.
Yeah.
Which I guess maybe that was, again, done as an assumption, because you would think, you know, if he's a dog-faced boy, he's burying bones in the backyard. And then when he's like, oh, your potato, I'm like, oh yeah, it was a potato. But yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, he does deliver a potato. It's such a funny way, like, such a dry, like, that David Duchovny, like, dry way of doing it, you know?
Yeah, very deadpan delivery.
Yeah.
And it just highlights again that their investigation is at a dead end at this point. You know, they've spent 10 minutes since of screen time since the murder, and they haven't really got any further in terms of solving the case. And then there's another murder. So Mr. Nutt, the motel manager, is murdered.
Which, okay, that one is believable because, okay, he's on his level. I'm still going to protest the artist's murder.
Yeah, he comes in through the dog flap, is that right?
Yes.
So, because it's for a dog, you know, Mulder and Scully have decided that it's probably Dr. Blockhead, and they head off to arrest him.
Oh, yes, because the Enigma, or I forgot his name in the show.
The Conundrum.
Dropped off the rent, yeah, the Conundrum. He dropped off the rent check, which was pinned to his loincloth. This is so weird. And he chases the dog, and then that's why the pin ends up there, and they assume that it was Dr. Blockhead.
Yeah, and they've done some background checking, and they reveal that Dr. Blockhead does not hold a doctorate as well, which I thought was a funny line.
Yeah, like duh.
Yeah, and the sheriff detains Lanny, who's kind of upset, isn't he? He's been drinking, and he's upset at the murder. So Mulder and Scully have gone to arrest Dr. Blockhead, and Lanny's been taken into custody for his own good. So they go to see Dr. Blockhead, and when they try to arrest him, he wants to see a lawyer, doesn't he? And he says, who's your lawyer? And he represents himself.
Yeah.
That's kind of a classic Darren Morgan. You know, he sets up a punchline and then he sort of subverts it.
Right.
I think it always works. He tries to escape, doesn't he? Mulder falls on a bed of nails, which he says is more comfortable than a futon. And the sheriff actually appears and catches, or he apprehends Dr. Blockhead.
Yes, because he has a whole bunch of hooks to his chest, and he just grabs it by the string.
Yeah, and he goes, ow! Yeah. And then we go to the prison. So Lanny's in prison by himself, and it's off-screen, I think, but Lenny detaches himself from Lanny at this point, and he heads off. Yeah, and what I was talking about earlier was, in terms of them swapping roles, is that Scully actually solves the case, because Scully comes up with a theory that Lenny is committing the murders. Normally, we'd expect Mulder to have a big sort of leap of intuition, but in this one, Mulder doesn't really do that. It's Scully who puts the pieces together. And in a few of the Darren Morgan episodes, Scully has much more of an active role in solving the case than is usual. So he's quite good in that respect, I think. He gives Scully a lot to do.
Not only that, but also, like, again, changes the role where she's less of... I don't want to say less of the skeptic, but she's more apt to listening to the impossible and somehow working it into solving whatever case they have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing with, like, Clyde Bruckman, you know. Eventually she, like, figures out, you know, or at least believes in what happened, you know, with his ability by the end, sadly, you know. So, he does a good job of, like, I guess the curveball.
Yeah.
That should be the theme of this episode, the curveball.
The curveball episode.
You know, you know, what you expect from her, but, you know, she does what you wouldn't expect, you know. So, and it just fleshes out her character even more. It makes her not so, you know, one-dimensional. You know?
Yeah, he always writes Scully in a very interesting way. And he always pokes fun at Mulder, and we'll talk a bit more about that when we get to that scene. That scene you've already described, where he with Mulder's pose,
right?
But back in the prison, then, so Lanny has a bit of an emotional scene where he talks about, you know, what it's been like for him, and how could he turn his brother in without turning himself in? In the middle of this very humorous episode, it's quite a moving moment, I think.
Yeah. It's sad. It's kind of sad. You feel bad for him. Like, you see why he's, you know, drinking, and then you think, oh boy, what, like, you don't even want to arrest the guy. Like, how do you, it's not his fault, you know, he couldn't help it. And, you know, he's heartbroken. And then, it relates back to the story of Chang and Aang, of one dying and then the other one knowing that a part of him is dead, that he can't do anything but follow, and living with that, and how terrifying that is. You know, that's why he died of fright, you know, according to the lore.
Yeah, and Kim Manners actually talked a bit about what they were going for with this scene. So he said that they wanted to play it for real compassion and sympathy and make it an honest, heartfelt moment. And I think it succeeds in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Manners said that it made me feel good that in the middle of this carnival of fun, we could give the audience a scene where there was a guy who was really dying of alcoholism, and we showed his pain about his twin brother that he had taken care of and done everything for. He had nothing in his life because of this brother. And that scene paid off. I felt really good about it. Yeah, and I'd agree that they succeeded with that, definitely.
When you think about it, too, maybe Lenny was trying not... You know, Lenny knew that his brother, who was hosting him, was dying, and he didn't want to die.
Mm.
So that's why he, like, detached himself. Unlike Chang and A, he was able to detach himself and try to find someone else to live with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that he didn't love his brother.
Yeah.
But, you know, then you think about that, like, oh, he's just trying to live, because if he stays connected to this guy, he's going to die with him, you know? And then you're like, oh, man, now you don't feel bad for this super strong mutant thing that just sleeps out of nowhere and attacks people, you know? It's funny how, like, the episode ends up making you think of it in that way after you've gone through all this silliness and, you know, fun humor and stuff like that. And then when you get to that part, it's like, oh wow, that's pretty sad.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although, to go back to what you said earlier about how fast Lenny is, you know, he's had quite a while to get away, but still, when Scully looks out of the prison window, you know, he's not that far away.
Right.
And yeah, so they chase him to the fun house, the Tabernacle of Terror.
Terror, yes.
And again, this is another example of, I think this scene works pretty good, pretty well. But Darren Morgan wasn't happy with how the funhouse sequence turned out, because he was inspired by a Charlie Chaplin film called The Circus, which it is a good film. I could recommend that to anyone who likes silent films. And he brought a videotape of that film to him to show to Kim Manners and the art department. But in the end, the scene ended up a lot shorter and simpler than what Morgan had hoped for, because they had to film it late at night and they'd been working for 15 hours already. So Kim Manners said he didn't have enough time to shoot it. He basically rushed through getting all the shots that they needed in about 45 minutes, whereas Morgan had envisaged, I think, that they'd spend a lot of time getting it just right. But Manners sort of says that, you know, that's the way TV works sometimes. Sometimes you just got to take what you can get.
I thought the scene was great.
Yeah, I think so too.
It almost reminded me too a little bit of the scene from Enter the Dragon at the
end. Oh, yes, yeah.
You know, the mirror room and stuff like that. So that definitely reminded me a little bit. The only criticism I would give to the scene is the puppet. It's like that was the one mistake they made. Like, I think every other scene where, like, you know, this creature was attacking was good, that, you know, they didn't really show it. They show quick flash shots. But, you know, the two times they show it in this scene, it's in, like, light.
Yeah.
And it's obviously a rubber thing on a stick that they shake around a corner and then back it up. And it's like, oh, like, why'd you do that? Like, you know, that's the one criticism I will give. If Darren was going to be upset about anything in that scene, it should have been that. But I thought everything else with the mirror tricks and stuff like that, I thought that worked well. I thought it worked just fine. If it would have been longer, I think it actually might have taken away from it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I suppose, again, it's one of those things where Darren Morgan probably has an idea in his head of...
Right, something grander.
Yeah. But obviously, as an audience, as audience members, we don't know what he had planned. And
right.
Yeah, right. I agree with what you said. So, well, what happens, though, is that Lenny escapes, but he's eaten by the conundrum. So the conundrum had no trouble catching him, and he eats him very quickly as well.
Because, yeah, Jesus Christ. Like, he didn't even have any stains on his face, nothing. Yeah. He was just sitting there in a food coma. Yeah.
He just, you know,
in his one food baby.
In one gulp, he took him right down. Yeah.
Meanwhile, he was chomping on that fish like he couldn't get through it. So, yeah. Again, it's X-Files.
Yeah.
Suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, and Mulder and Scully don't suspect anything either, strangely, right. I think.
They just see the weirdo laying on the floor, and they're like, okay, whatever. Just run away, you know, like, keep going.
Yeah. And then the next scene is in the daylight. So we get told that Lanny died.
From cirrhosis of the liver.
Yeah, he actually dies of cirrhosis of the liver. And then we're on to the part that you talked about, where Blockhead's got a very nice, or very, very interesting sort of monologue about the eradication of normality and how things are going to look in the future, and that, you know, the way society's going, that there won't be the same tolerance for deviations from the norm, is what he's talking about, isn't it? And he says, in the future, everybody's going to look like that. And he points to Mulder. And Mulder's just got the most incredible sort of...
it's like posture. The wind is blowing. He's got his hands on his hips. The trench coat is behind him. He got one foot up on a step. It's just a fantastic scene. Like, what a cutaway. It's every time I see it, similar to how you have a reaction to the potato line.
Yeah.
Every time I see that scene, I crack up laughing because it is just perfect.
It is.
He's like, it'll look just like him. And it's like, it's such a, what a great, great scene. That is like my favorite scene in the episode. Definitely.
Yeah, definitely, and it's down. It's a recurring theme of Darren Morgan's that Mulder is presented as being a bit more ridiculous in his episodes than some of the other writers. So if you think about another example would be in Jose Chung's From Outer Space, where yes. You get the Mulder Yelp scene.
Yes!
Yeah, again, that's one of those that I can't watch the scene with the yelp and not laugh. It's just
yes.
I know exactly when it's coming. I know exactly what it's going to sound like. But
and you've
just
seen
kinda,
it a million times, and yeah. Every time you just crack up. It is so fantastic.
It just creeps up on me, yeah. I don't know. What Morgan said was he doesn't mind making fun of Mulder because he's presented as the seeker of the truth. And Morgan says that, to me, such people are always a bit ridiculous. And, yeah, he takes every opportunity he can to sort of skewer Mulder a bit. I think it's very funny. What is it now? We're 22 years on from Humbug. And how is Dr. Blockhead's prediction, you know?
Pretty accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, this was in what? 1990 what?
1995,
this episode? Yeah. And... Yeah. I mean, that scene itself, just that scene alone, is just so significant and is so relevant to now. It's amazing that it was written so long ago and, like, it still holds, like, true to today, you know? And I just am always amazed by writers how, you know, they can write these things that just... You know, they just have that ability to just tap into something that is just so relatable ages and ages from the day they wrote it, you know, and it doesn't change. And that's why I could still find it so humorous now, like, and so true, because it even works today.
Yeah, because if you look back at some of the first and second season episodes, not all of them have aged in the same respect very well. I'm thinking of stuff like Excelsis Day, for example, and maybe something like Shapes, where this episode, by contrast, seems kind of ahead of the curve, doesn't it? Like you say. Whereas if you went back to Excelsis Day and you look at the way it sort of talks about the Asian orderly, for example, I mean, you make allowances for the fact it was 20 years, but it still sort of sticks out a bit. Whereas this sort of sticks out a bit as being a bit sort of ahead of its time in a way. And then the episode ends with the conundrum is unwell. And he says that it must have been something he ate. Yeah.
The first time he actually says something, then nobody thinks talks.
Yeah.
Or he was even said, even Dr. Blockhead says he doesn't talk.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, he goes, oh, it must be something I ate. And then smiles, like, gives that smile, like, gotcha.
Yeah. So I'd like to think that after the camera stopped rolling, Mulder and Scully figured out what had happened, but who knows?
Yeah, or just give it a quick thought, and then similar to how they just ignored him, just like, maybe, nah. And then just like, he's just scurrying along. They just think he just got away.
All right, so that's the end of Humbug. So, yeah, I've enjoyed talking about that, to be honest. There's definitely a lot more good than bad in this episode, isn't there?
Definitely. And I mean, it's one of the most more, consistent scene after scene. It just works. There's no real dip, with exception to the fact that this little thing took out all these people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just a well-structured episode from start to finish, and it has a lot of themes that reoccur in it. Like I said, the dichotomy, the idea of, you know, expectations of people and reality, and how you can't always, you know, the whole can't judge a book by its cover theme. Like, it just plays constantly in each scene in some way that just works really, really well. And just, you know, it just plays through perfectly in the episode.
It does, yeah. And this is an interesting point in the series, isn't it? Because we've had this one, and recently we've had things like Irresistible and Colony and...
Well, yeah, that's the other thing, too, about this episode. Like, I was looking at it, and, when I was taking out the discs, and I'm like, you know, going to, if you remember how the original sets were, it's like it folded out and it had all the discs in order. And I'm like, looking, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this is like all the way near the end. And I was like, holy crap, this is like one of the, so I was like, so we already went through her abduction and her near death and Scully coming back to life. And I was like, we went through all of this, and now we get, like, we're here, and, like, it's just, like, another day in the X-Files. Like that's crazy. Like, I just found it crazy that the episode is there after everything that they just went through in the beginning of this season. It's pretty incredible.
And it is, yeah.
And it just, like, it just doesn't, like, you wouldn't think it would be there. Like, it doesn't feel like it fits in there. But it works. You know what I mean? Like, you would think, I don't know, after all this dramatic stuff, like, you wouldn't think that, like, this quote-unquote humorous comedic episode would work after the season that the series, like, at that point had just had. And it's just, like, a great break from all of that. And it just works so well. And I just found it surprising. Like, I feel like I saw this episode in the beginning of the season. You know what I mean? And then when I'm looking at it, I'm like, holy crap, no, it's like near the end of the season. And the season that has the most episodes.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's had 25 episodes in this season.
Yeah, it's the only one with 25. Most, you know, nothing else had, you know, a couple had 24. I think Chris Carter was right in that quote I said earlier, you know, 45 episodes in, roughly. You know, if they'd done this after 10 or 20, probably too soon. But at this stage, it's
like,
the right...
it works. Yeah, for some reason it works.
It was the right time to be experimenting, I think. Excellent. So that wraps up our detailed look at Humbug.
21st century genetic engineering will not only eradicate the Siamese twins and the alligator-skinned skin people, but you're going to be hard-pressed to find a slight overbite or not so high cheekbone. You see, I've seen the future, and the future looks just like him. Imagine going through your whole life looking like that. That's why it's left up to the self-made freaks like me in the conundrum to remind people.
Remind people of what?
Nature abhors normality. You can't go very long without creating a mutant. You know why?
No, why?
I don't either. It's a mystery. Maybe some mysteries are never meant to be solved.
Okay, Tanya, so if you're willing, we can put you through your paces on the X quiz.
Okay, I hope it's not too specific. Oh God! Don't tell me, like, what was the name of this person on the board? Like, oh hey, I haven't studied X Files like that in ages, so we'll see how I do.
Let's see how you do.
Anybody listening, please be forgiving. Okay, I'm old. I'm getting old. Okay,
please bear that in mind. Yeah, I think there's a couple you'd be able to have a good go at.
Okay,
I think there are a couple which might be a bit obscure, but let's see. Question one. So, Gerald Glazebrook, the alligator man, is killed in the teaser sequence.
Mm-hmm.
What is the slogan we see on his van? So this is the final shot of that opening sequence, yeah. It's a question. It's in the form of a question. I can give you that clue.
I can't remember.
Okay. So,
I give up.
His van, it's, is he a man, is he an animal, or is he a monster?
Right.
Which, again, it's very, you know, it's believable that that's the slogan he would have.
Right.
And it also ties into the wider themes of the episode again, doesn't it?
So right, is it a man, is it a monster? Yeah. That's good. Okay. That wasn't too bad. Had I been constantly watching the series every single day, I would have gotten that one.
Yeah, right. Question two. I'm not sure if you'll get this. Let's see. Right. Name three of the items that Dr. Blockhead says the conundrum will eat. So this is when he's talking to Mulder and Scully.
Light bulbs
is one, yeah.
I know he said light bulbs.
Yeah.
Does he say rocks?
No.
I know he mentioned some other creature.
He's not specific about the creature. He's quite general. I don't know if that helps.
Okay. I just remember light bulbs because it's like, of course he would eat light bulbs.
So the first thing he says is live animals.
Live animals, okay.
Then he says dead animals. Then he says light bulbs.
Right.
Corkscrews.
Okay.
Battery cables. And the final one he says is cranberries.
And cranberries, that's right.
All right.
Yeah, I got one.
Yeah, you got one. I'll give you half a mark for that. Okay.
Oh, this is terrible. I'm going to lose my Xbox credentials.
Yeah. Question three. According to the curator, in what year did Chang and Eng die? I'll tell you what, I'll accept. Do you know?
I was going to say 1800s.
Yeah, do you want to have a guess at the decade? It is the 1800s. If you can get the decade, I'll...
70s?
It is the 1870s. Well done, yeah. Excellent.
Okay. So, what was the date?
It was actually 1874, to be precise.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes.
Oh, good okay. stuff.
Redeeming myself.
Yeah. I think you'll get this one. So, question four. If the sheriff is correct, how do you get rid of warts?
Bury the potato under the full moon.
Yeah, you
after you rubbed it on your
yes,
hand.
Yeah, yes. you rub a sliced potato on your hand and bury it under a full moon. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Whether that works or not, I'm not certain, to be honest.
I've never heard of that, except in this show, to be honest.
So what we need is, listeners, if anyone wants to try that for us and drop us a line, let us know if it works, okay?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
I am too. All right, so that's good. So you've got 2.5 out of 4 so far. And the final question is a quote. So I'll give you the quote, and you just need to tell me who said it and generally in what context, if you can. Okay. So the quote is, oh, I'm doing that as we speak.
Oh. when Dr. Blockhead talks about the yogi and how you can take your testicles and pull them up into your body. And Mulder tells him, oh, I'm doing that as we speak.
Exactly. That's what it is.
Oh, such a great line. That guy had some, they gave him some really good lines. Some really, like, and he just plays them off like you know, just, yeah, and cranberries. Like, what?
Yeah, he definitely had a keen sense of timing, didn't he? It was really good.
Yes, absolutely. And it played perfect against David, too.
Yeah.
Like, who again, has really great timing with his, like, deadpan humor and stuff.
Yeah.
So. They had some really good scenes, really good lines together.
Yeah, I wonder what David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, I wonder how they felt when they received this script. You know, I wonder if it was surprise, you know, or whether it was, they might have regarded it as a great, like, opportunity, you know, to sort of do something different.
Yeah, I'm curious too. I'm curious too.
Well, Tanya, you needn't have worried really, because you've... you definitely didn't disgrace yourself on the X quiz.
Yeah. Okay. Like I said, I hope you weren't going to ask me, like, a name of somebody in the ledger, because I was like, I did not catch that. For anything, like, really specific. Like, Kaiser Sosa, it was on the board. Like, you know, I was hoping it wasn't going to be one of those things. But thank you. Those questions were good. I like them.
Yeah. 3.5 out of 5. So, very respectable score, I think.
Thank you.
All right. So, that was the X quiz. All that's left for me to do now is to basically to thank you, Tanya, for joining me to talk about Humbug. It's been great fun.
Yes, I really enjoyed it. I'm glad I got to do another episode, and that it was this episode, which is one of my favorites. And thank you very much. I had a good time speaking with you and reminiscing. Anytime I could talk to somebody about X-Files, it's always a good time for me. So yeah, thanks again.
It's always time well spent. Listeners, we'd love you to get in touch with us and let us know what you think about this episode. So you can do that, like I said at the beginning of the episode, you know, you can get in touch with us on Twitter or on Facebook, so please feel free to do that. Tanya, are you on social media at all? Where can people find you online?
I am on Twitter at Amazon Agent. Also on YouTube, you can find me there under Amazon Agent. I have some videos up there, a lot of gameplay videos, a couple of unboxings. Like I mentioned, I just shot an unboxing of me opening up this Blu-ray box set of X-Files, so I'm going to put that up hopefully today. And by the time you hear this, it'll definitely be up, so please check it out. And you can also catch me on Instagram at Amazon Agent as well. I've been collecting X-Files pins, so I've been putting up some sweet pins on there along with other geeky stuff that I like, so you can check me out there as well.
Excellent, that sounds brilliant. Alright, so my thanks once again to Tanya Hernandez, and my thanks to you for listening. So until next time, remember, trust no one.
The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter @IamWillAye.